From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 12, 2003. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As the Reconstruction debate rages, why are research universities in the US receiving money from military contracts? It's the 55th anniversary of the UN resolution affirming the Palestinian right of return. And will it be peace at last or lasting peace between India and Pakistan? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, the Japan Confederation of A and H Bomb Sufferers Organization handed in petitions to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum over a new display they say covers the real consequences of the atomic bomb the United States dropped on Hiroshima. Keiko Ogura is the director of Hiroshima Interpreters for Peace. She was 8 years old and living in Hiroshima when Enola Gay dropped the bomb.
They should know, younger generation just adore, oh, that's the great weapon. I don't want them to think so, that because of that great weapon, they say, great aircraft, so many people died. But still, if it is used to prevent the future war, that will be very meaningful.
The director of the Air and Space Museum has refused to meet with the group. The United States government just approved funding for the next generation of nuclear weapons. And a Pentagon audit finds the Halliburton subsidiary working for the U.S. military in Iraq is overbilling taxpayers for their work. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Today, the Pentagon alleged Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root did not do everything required under government contracting rules to find the best possible price for goods procured under a no-bid contract. The Pentagon's Defense Contract Audit Agency said Halliburton may have overbilled taxpayers by as much as $61 million for trucking gasoline into Iraq and by as much as $67 million for cafeteria services. Critics of Halliburton contracts have long argued taxpayers are spending too much for scant results. The Pentagon refuses to pay the $67 million difference in the cafeteria bill, and Halliburton may have to forfeit the $61 million in fuel overcharges. Today, the Corps of Engineers assigned Halliburton a $200 million task order for more work in Iraq's oil fields. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
Latinos and Latinas in California are being urged to strike, boycott shops, and keep their children out of school today, protesting a repeal of the short-lived law allowing undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. Kelly Ramirez has more.
The controversial licensing law, signed by Governor Gray Davis a few months ago in an attempt to defeat his recall, was quickly repealed once Arnold Schwarzenegger, who opposed it, became governor. The one-day Latino boycott, prompted by the repeal, is intended to show support for often exploited undocumented immigrants and to demonstrate the economic strength of Latinos, who are one-third of California's population. But a widespread boycott may negatively impact Latinos themselves. Half the students in the San Jose Unified School District are Latino. Karen Fuqua, school district spokeswoman, spoke by cell phone from San Diego.
We were encouraging our parents to send their students to school because we felt with the students at school that that was only damaging to their education. We are in a financial crisis, and with students not coming to school, that does have a financial impact on our schools also. It's approximately $38 a day that we get per student.
For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
A top U.S. official confirms the U.S. government is working on developing a new technology that will keep track of foreign nationals while in the United States. Shannon Young reports from Miami Beach.
The Department of Homeland Security's new program, known as U.S. Visit, was discussed in reference to enforcement of the so-called Third Border, an area including Latin America and the Caribbean. The program plans to use the registration of biometric data as well as the potential use of radio frequency identification technology in the visas themselves. Privacy advocates are concerned about RFID technology. They say since one tiny RFID chip can store a wealth of personal information, it can also serve for physical tracking purposes. The Department of Homeland Security is currently accepting bids for what could potentially be a $1 billion program. From Miami Beach, this is Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the United States Embassy in Haiti's capital was reportedly closed a portion of the day until officials there could confirm calm in the city. Police fired tear gas and warning shots yesterday outside the presidential palace in Port-au-Prince at thousands of students calling for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to step down. Other Haitian nationals charge the protesters are funded by the U.S. government and represent the elite class who protest Aristide's more populist policies. President Aristide has formally condemned the violence on both sides. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Human Rights Watch said today that scores of Iraqi civilians were killed or injured needlessly because Britain failed in its duty as an occupying power in its use of cluster bombs and the failure to secure Iraqi munitions dumps. This as the Bush administration has delayed the bidding process for the $18.6 billion in reconstruction money for Iraq. It's unclear, however, whether the delay is due to the international outrage that only corporations from countries that supported the invasion were eligible for primary contracts. Yet even within the U.S. there's outrage over the contracts, with residents of New Mexico wondering why the University of New Mexico, a self-described research university, is receiving money for research from military contracts. KUNM's Leslie Clark has this report.
Trey Smith, a senior at the University of New Mexico, has spent the past couple of years researching military contracts at UNM.
A lot of this research that's being done has global implications. And you have different departments on campus like the Institute for Space and Nuclear Power Studies, which gets millions of dollars every year from the Department of Defense. The United Nations has a treaty that every country except the United States has signed saying we will not use space for warfare. But that's what, right here at UNM, we are working on that.
UNM President Luis Caldera is new to the university, having served as Secretary of the Army under then-Energy Secretary Bill Richardson. Richardson, now Governor of New Mexico, was instrumental, some say, in recruiting Caldera to the university post for the express purpose of obtaining research funding from the military. President Caldera argues the same research used for military purposes can also be used for the benefit of society.
Frankly, some of that research, we ought not think of it as war research, but really as research that prevents wars and that protects human life and certainly the lives of non-combatants. That same basic research, yes, it can be used for military purposes. It can be also used to fight diseases that don't have cures for today. It can also be used to create new products and services that improve the qualities of people's life. So it isn't, in many cases, it's the application of the research. It's not what the research is. I think we have a good balance in our portfolio of research, and that's one thing we'd want to have as a research university.
UNM professor and local activist Bob Anderson disagrees with Caldera's assertion that good can come out of military research.
The International Electrical Engineers Society has just published an article called The Dawn of the E-Bomb, and it's been developed right here on campus by one of the faculty. The essence of this, it's an electronic bomb or a huge flying microwave that can destroy electronic equipment in a huge area of a city or a target zone.
President Caldera admits if some of the research done at UNM gets into the wrong hands, the results could be devastating. Roger Hagengruber has recently come to direct UNM's Institute for Public Policy after spending more than 15 years in weapons research for Sandia National Labs in Albuquerque. Hagengruber says some government contracts threaten UNM's educational mission and academic ideals. But both Hagengruber and President Caldera say checks and balances are in place to ensure the university's research is pertinent and ethical. But oversight can only be effective if all relevant information is available, according to UNM student Trey Smith.
If you remember last year, there was a big fiasco about how the president has to have a top security clearance to be chosen. Well, what we thought is, why does the president need this top security clearance? And so I wrote a letter about it, and Public Affairs wrote me back and they said, well, we can't give you the names of the professors that are doing this research because it's a risk to national security. And again, I think, you know, this is a public university. My tuition, my personal money is going towards this place, publicly funded, and I can't find out what's going on my own campus.
While President Caldera and university officials work to join Ivy League schools as a top research university, some New Mexicans fear UNM will experience the same kinds of philosophical, ethical, and legal violations as those schools. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque.
A week after his meeting with the authors of the Geneva Accord, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell met yesterday with Palestinian intellectual Sari Nusseibeh, the co-author of the popular Campaign for Peace and Democracy, a peace petition that calls for Palestinian state within the 1967 borders and asks Palestinians to give up the refugees' right to return. Yesterday also marked the 55th anniversary of the passing of the UN Resolution 194, which affirmed the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes inside Israel. Our correspondent Mohammed Halaini has more from Gaza.
We oppose the Geneva Accord and consider it unfair to us because it denies us our right to return to our homes in Palestine.
Abu Muhammad Qweder's family lived for generations in El Sawafir village, 30 kilometers east of Gaza City. He was forced to flee in 1948 when the Palestinian refugee exodus happened. He currently lives in the Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood of Gaza City. The right of return he so passionately defends is legally based on United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194, which explicitly states in paragraph 11,
refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date.
And that is what Abu Muhammad Qweder wants.
I want to return to my village. Even if it is under Israeli sovereignty, I would never give up what is rightfully mine.
Here, in a copy of the Geneva Accord that was made available to Israelis and Palestinians by mail, in newspapers, and over the internet, it states in Article 7 that Palestinian refugees will have several options for their residence, calling the alternative locations a compromise to the issue of Palestinian right of return. The architects of the accord propose that Palestinians can return to a future Palestinian state, Palestinians can settle in their current host country or another country of their choosing, and the final option proposes that Palestinians can return to their lands within the borders of Israel, provided that Israel allows refugees wishing to exercise this option to return, thus countering the mandate of UN Resolution 194. The authors of the Geneva Accord say it is a model agreement to jumpstart Palestinian and Israeli officials who have failed thus far to reach a working agreement. But Palestinians here perceive the Geneva Accord as more dangerous than a hypothetical agreement. They worry that the same people who endorsed the Geneva Accord and made the concessions will probably be in the position to make concessions in future official negotiations. This reporter spoke to Samer Zakout, who is a member of the Palestinian National Initiative, a grassroots movement that aims for peace by unifying the Palestinian leadership and reforming Palestinian public institutions.
In the future, Palestinian negotiators could be challenged by Israeli negotiators with the Geneva Accord. In other words, future Israeli negotiators will contend that since prominent Palestinians agreed to the concessions given in the Geneva Accord, they could agree to similar concessions and disregard the rulings of international legitimacy.
It seems like Samer's fears are not unfounded. Dr. Riyad Zanoun is a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council who is in favor of the Geneva Accord, but has reservations about the proposed compromise on the right of return. This reporter asked Zanoun if he thought that the Geneva Accord might be implemented in reality in the future.
I think so, because what was in this Geneva document is not far from what has been discussed in White River and in Camp David.
The architects of the Geneva Accord say that both sides have made compromises. The Israelis will withdraw from the Gaza Strip and most of the West Bank settlements and give the Palestinian state sovereignty over Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem and a capital in the Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. The Palestinians, in return, are asked to give up the right of return to their homes inside Israel. The question remains amongst Palestinians. Should they be required to forfeit the right of return already mandated by international law and the United Nations, in order to obtain limited sovereignty over Jerusalem and an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank settlements, something that is also mandated by the United Nations and international law? For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Mohammed Ghalaini.
It appears that grand overtures towards peace are being made in South Asia, as this week the Pakistani Prime Minister assured Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee of a grand welcome when he lands in Islamabad on January 4 to attend a meeting of the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, or SARC. The friendly overtures between the nation's leaders has also trickled down to the business elite. According to a Pakistani media report, entrepreneurs are buying land around an entry point between India and Pakistan, which is expected to become part of a trading zone. This is seen as a clear sign that the normalization process between the two traditional enemies is leading towards durable peace in the region. Masroor Hussain reports from Islamabad.
Life-size replica of a missile erected in front of the Pakistani parliament in Islamabad comes down today, showing the change in the mindset of the Pakistani government. In a quick succession of events, Pakistan announced major confidence-building measures for the past 2 weeks. A ceasefire has been maintained, followed by Pakistan's announcement to allow Indian flights over its airspace. A day later, a meeting between Indian and Pakistani officials in New Delhi agreed on allowing direct flights to each other's country. Then Musharraf offered withdrawing Pakistani troops from the Indian border. India offered to revive a rail link with Pakistan. Ashad Bhatti is a peace activist whose popular coffee shop has invited Vajpayee to come visit them during his stay in Islamabad.
We'll be giving more valuable input for better planning, which will definitely benefit people. Because of the border tensions and close border, we are constrained to have trade with other countries, whereas there's so much potential of trade between Punjab, East Punjab and West Punjab, and India and Pakistan in general, and from Bombay and Mumbai and Karachi, and through Kashmir also. And that trade will, of course, generate jobs. That trade will generate better relations.
What made Islamabad take a U-turn and offer measures that would have been considered treason 4 years ago? Tahira Abdullah is firebrand peace activist and one of the founding members of Pakistan-India Peace Forum.
You're asking the million-dollar question. Well, obviously, we all know that Pakistan is under the American influence. We are well aware of the fact that after 9/11/2001, President General Musharraf of Pakistan knuckled under to President Bush's demands, and whatever was demanded by the United States government has been done by President Musharraf. So the short answer to your question is yes, Pakistan has come under the influence of the United States.
India and Pakistan have fought 3 wars with each other over Kashmir. India claims it is one of its states, while Pakistan contests that India in 1948 occupied the territory then governed by an independent ruler, Ranjit Singh. In 1989, freedom groups in Kashmir launched a movement leading to a militant upsurge. According to an estimate, some 80,000 Kashmiri militants have died so far. India accuses Pakistan of providing arms and training to these groups, but the Pakistani government denies that and calls Kashmiri militants freedom fighters. Tahira Abdullah again.
I think there comes a time when if certain set of people want independence, they will have to get it. I think the time has come that we heed what the people of Kashmir are saying on both sides of the LOC. The people now are calling for Azadi. This is a simple Urdu word which, when translated, means independence. And I think that the time has come for the Pakistani government and the Indian government to show some maturity and to give them the freedom.
According to a recent newspaper editorial, Pakistan has lost hundreds of innocent lives and millions of dollars in lost investment and defense expenditures because of its 56-year-old antagonism with India. And so has India. Muhammad Yunus is an ethnic Kashmiri settled in Pakistan.
People of both India and Pakistan want peace in the region, because if there is peace, they will be able to participate in each other's welfare and will be able to lead a peaceful life. I would like to appeal to the government of Pakistan as well as the government of India to let us, the people of this region, live in peace.
According to independent observers, ending hostilities between India and Pakistan could be a historic opportunity. Normal relations will, among other things, allow both countries a chance to divert huge defense expenditures towards the welfare of the people who are among the poorest in the world. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandes. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. Hundreds of people from 27 countries arrived last week at World Bank headquarters located in Washington, D.C. to compete for funding for their development projects at the World Bank's Development Marketplace. Only 47 projects were picked to share more than $6 million in grant money. Ellie Walton reports from D.C.
The World Bank has received heavy criticism for its top-down approach to poverty reduction. The development marketplace is an example of a possible change in the World Bank strategy by sidestepping both the bank and government bureaucracy in order to directly fund grassroots initiatives using local ideas. Edward Fenier, who is from Suriname and one of the winners of the grants, discusses his project's work to integrate traditional healing practices into the country's established health programs.
One of the important things of the project is that people can gain trust between the traditional healers and the Western medicine-trained health assistant of our organization. And this can be done when they exchange knowledge and ways of working.
Despite the focus of the development marketplace on grassroots funding, the World Bank mainly gives loans to governments. John Wilton, Vice President of Strategy, Finance, and Risk Management at the World Bank, comments on the bank's limitations.
I would certainly like to see more resources going to development marketplace activities, but it's the outcome of a complex decision-making process.
Critics say that since the bank is under the direction of the U.S. Treasury, it remains undemocratic and unable to meet global demands. 50 years is enough, a World Bank watchdog, remains highly critical of the bank's supposed shift in dealing with poverty. Soren Ambrose, senior policy analyst at 50 Years is Enough, says that the development marketplace does not challenge the root of the problem.
Although I think we may have opened up room for debate at the World Bank, ultimately they're only accountable to the finance ministries of the G7 countries, and because of that, not a lot of change in their policies has happened, even if there has been change in the culture inside of the institutions. It's owned by the governments of the world, but it's not a one government, one vote system. It's a $1, one vote system, so that the countries who have put the most money into the bank over the years have the most votes, which means the U.S. has effective veto power over any policy changes at the institutions and controls over 15% of the votes on any decision whatsoever. So there's a real lack of transparency and a public accountability at the World Bank.
This is what democracy sounds like!
This is what democracy sounds like!
Earlier protests against the IMF and trade ministerials have prompted the World Bank to take notice of criticisms. Isabel Guerrero, country director of Mexico and Colombia, says the bank is listening.
I think a lot of people who are in the bank were activists at some point, and we're all inside here trying to change the world still. We're learning all the time, and that's what is good, to be open to admitting mistakes, because development is such a complex issue. And I think the challenge for us, and the challenge when I'm thinking about the strategies in the countries that I'm working now, is how do you get to the grassroots while still working with the government but really supporting this type of initiatives. One of the ideas was that the development marketplace would generate ideas which would then be scaled up in our projects. And that is just starting to happen. It's much easier said than done.
Current president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, started the development marketplace 6 years ago in light of criticism. The next president of the United States will appoint his successor, a crucial decision which will impact whether the shift in bank strategy found within the development marketplace will extend to more bank programs. Yet another reason to get out and vote. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ellie Walton. Thanks to Selena Masuta for help on this report.
22 years ago this week, Mumia Abu-Jamal was arrested for the fatal shooting of police officer Daniel Faulkner. Mumia remains on death row in Pennsylvania, despite the fact that another man, Arnold Beverly, has confessed to the killing of Officer Faulkner and has passed two lie detector tests regarding his testimony. The court refuses to hear his testimony and will not arrest him. This weekend, there will be mobilizations around the country calling for justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And from his death row cell, Mumia calls for justice for Nathaniel Jones, who was beaten to death by police in Cincinnati.
Here we go again, laments a Cincinnati religious leader as local and national TV stations broadcast the harrowing footage of cops beating a black man, striking him with long truncheons, perhaps two dozen times. The Reverend Damon Lynch, Jr., pastor of the New Jerusalem Baptist Church, is not alone in that sentiment. Cincinnati is but the latest of a long train of abuses. This latest is based on that often used pretext, the big nigger defense. It is used in the infamous beating of Rodney King in L.A. One of the cops charged spiced up the imagery by likening him to a gorilla. A decade before Rodney King became a household name, a man named Delbert Africa was beaten, rifle-butted, and repeatedly kicked while giving up after the 1978 Philadelphia police assault on the home and headquarters of the MOVE organization. Initially, the city's police chief denied Africa was beaten. In fact, all the men were beaten that day. But the videotapes made it difficult to disprove Delbert's pummeling. When a trial took place, the cops took the stand to announce they were in fear of Delbert because of his muscles. The judge would dismiss the jury and proclaim them not guilty, ignoring videotaped evidence. Now a man named Nathaniel Jones is beaten to a pulp on tape in Cincinnati. When he dies, the first thing the corporate media proclaims is his size. On some early reports, Mr. Jones was described as nearly 400 pounds. It took a day or so to shrink to around 350 pounds. Still, we see the rudiments of the BND, the Big Nigger Defense. Six cops, each armed with a variety of weapons, were threatened by the BND syndrome. Of course, almost predictably, drugs have been introduced into the case. If it were not so tragic, it would be almost comic. One is reminded of a routine done by comedian Dave Chappelle. He describes cops beating a black person into the concrete. The cops get together, and one tells the other, "Okay, let's just sprinkle some crack on him and get out of here." That line never fails to score laughs from the audience. It is so deep in American consciousness that it has become a national private joke. It is a joke that stems from something deadly serious. And it stems from a national problem that shows no sign of abatement. For far too many men and women, it is no laughing matter. There's not a social explosion in the last half of the 20th century that did not stem from events of just this nature. From Watts of 1965 to Los Angeles of 1992, the trigger has been the same: police violence against black people. Courts have issued judgments of up into the billions in total, but to no avail. Like cancer, it goes on and on and on. It matters not one whit what color the police chief or mayor is. It matters not whether there is a police accountability board or not. It matters not whether there is a Republican or Democratic administration in power nationally or locally. How many politicians, whether they're running for president or dog catcher, have raised the issue? How many have offered anything close to a solution? The solution will not come from City Hall. Indeed, often, City Hall is the problem. The solution will come from the people themselves, who organize themselves to make a difference directly. Our history provides many examples of when average, everyday people organized to change social problems. That time has surely come again. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million, and Lindsay Benedict. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.